We believe it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I'm one of them too, I must have this thing. Owen J. has this thing, and he's going to share it with us tonight. He's very active in the Friday night spiritual kindergarten here at NAVA. This will be the second time since I've been involved in the speaker meeting that Owen has shared, and he's quite a historian, so I hope he shares a little bit of his AA knowledge again with us. So welcome, Owen.
My name's Owen Jones, and I'm an alcoholic. And I haven't strangled anybody yet today. If you knew anything about my history, you'd say, that's a miracle. So, are we a glum lot tonight? The big book says we are not a glum lot. And I'm looking out at the faces of a whole bunch of alcoholics like me. And if you're like me and you've not had a drink today, you're a success. That's a huge, big deal. Regardless of whatever else is going on in our lives today, if we're an alcoholic, if you're an alcoholic, and you have not had a drink today, you're a success. Because most alcoholics cannot say that. Most alcoholics will never be able to say that because they've never had the opportunity to get what we have in here. And if you're like me and you haven't had a desire to drink today, well, I call that a miracle from God. Because I really don't think it's anything that I did on my own steam. You know, I did not stay sober today. I did not stay away from the thought of a drink today based on my own power. I do not believe. When left to my own devices, I go in the other direction. Believe me. And it may not even be drinking, but it's, you know, some crazy thing, you know, that I'm doing or thinking. You know, so if you're like me and did not have a desire to drink today, that's a miracle. And, you know, I'm very grateful for that. You know, if I stop being grateful or if I forget to be grateful, you know, that's, I'm getting off track, you know. Just that's why I'm here tonight, to be grateful and hopefully help you find some gratitude for what we've been given. I come from a really, really sick alcoholic family, and two of them are dead, two of them are still living, I think. As far as I know, I don't have any contact with them because they're just, you know, they're so sick that it makes me sick being around them. And I wish I could say that I was more spiritually powerful than that, but I'm not. But when I think about my family history, it is just so incredible that I'm here today. And that I have what you all have given me. It's just, you know, it's fantastic, it's wonderful, and it could have been much, much different. 25 years ago, last June, I was sitting in the office of a woman by the name of Geraldine Owen Delaney. No relation as far as we know. And at the time she was 77 years old and I was 33. And she was the founder and the director of a long-term rehab called Alina Lodge in Blairstown, New Jersey. Maybe somebody's been there or heard of it. You have. Okay. When she was there? Okay. And I'll tell you the reason why I was there in the first place, and I'll tell you why I was in her office. By the way, this is, as I said, a long-term rehab for what she used to call the reluctant to recover. Well, we're all kind of reluctant at some point, I think, but these were like special cases, and they mostly came from good families, moneyed families, good in that sense anyway, accomplished people, you know, who had gotten into serious trouble with drugs and alcohol and been through many treatment centers, and the parents had shelled out hundreds of thousands of dollars, and her deal was, well, you know, when they come here, they agree to stay until I say you're ready to go. And so it wasn't that unusual for somebody to be there for a year. Yeah. And some people never left. They just stayed and worked there the rest of their lives. and her her husband had been an AA member and actually got sober in AA and Bill W.'s group before she did, back around 1945 and in Manhattan. And she came in a couple of years later to the same group. And she used to say that she would come into the meeting, she'd talk about how she was overworked and underpaid, and that was her problem. And Bill W. used to tell her, "Jerry, sit down and shut up." So that's, you know, from the horse's mouth to her, to me, to you. The reason I was there is a family member of mine, on my wife's side of the family, had gone there for treatment. And I got on the mailing list. And they sent out these newsletters. And I got one talking about an Al-Anon workshop for a week. Now, I knew that I had a problem. And I blamed it on my parents because I had a very angry, volatile, alcoholic dad, and my mother was a pill addict. I always thought she was a saint because she was so quiet and still and, you know, not argumentative and didn't get involved in all the yelling and screaming, and I didn't realize what there was really going on. But she had, like, you know, a pharmacy, you know, that was keeping her quiet. I had come to the conclusion that because of my horrific upbringing, I was borderline criminally insane, and that I was desperate that nobody find out what was really going on between my ears, and I was terrified that somebody would find out about my thoughts. And I was plagued by all kinds of morbid fears. I was sure I was going to lose my temper and kill somebody, or driving drunk, I was going to run over a little baby that was like walking in the street or something. And you know, I had a wife, a wonderful gal. She's still my first wife. I had three little children. And I guess I was just, I don't know. I felt like a billiard ball. You know, that's what I felt like, just being boom, 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 boom. That's how I felt all the time. I did not feel like I was in control of my life. I acted all the time like I was in control and like I knew what I was doing, and I had no clue. I was totally confused about who I was and what was going on, and yet I insisted that I really knew what I was doing. And it was very important for me to impress upon you the fact that I knew what I was doing. And I was in, so I signed up for this Al-Anon workshop at Alena Lodge. And this was going to solve my problems. And I had deduced that I would go there and they would say, "Well, poor little thing, you know. Poor little thing. We know how much you've hurt. We know how much you've suffered. Here, let's have a nice hug and it'll all be okay." See, I wanted somebody to just tell me that they understood, you know, what I'd been through. And if I could get somebody to understand and appreciate what I had been through, then somehow magically I don't know what was going to happen, but I just, for some reason, I thought that was going to make everything okay. Now, this does not maybe seem like a big deal to those of you who've had multiple DUIs and been arrested many times and divorced and been living on the street or whatever. But I was in seminary at the time, and right before I was scheduled to fly out to Alena Lodge to go to this Al-Anon workshop, my faculty advisor called me in, and he said, this is after my after two years in seminary, and he said, we had a faculty meeting about you, and we all decided that you should take a year off seminary and see a psychiatrist, and then don't come back. So I went home and told my wife, and she was crestfallen, not for me, but for her, because, you know, I think she felt she had sacrificed a lot to drop everything to, you know, support, you know, me emotionally through seminary and all this. And so that was very that was far more devastating than the faculty advisor telling me that they had kicked me out because I didn't like any of these people anyway. And part of me said they can have their damn seminary, but the other part of me was so prideful that, you know, I wanted to manipulate them into keeping me and, you know, like, well, I'll show you guys who's really smart, and I'm going to win this battle. And I did. And I'm not sure that that was the right decision, but, it, you know, it is what it is. But I went to them and I said, look, well, I know I have problems. And just to show you that I'm, you know, sincere and serious about this, I've already made plans to go to this Al-Anon workshop because I come from an alcoholic family. And so that really put them on the spot, you know, and they would have sounded just really cruel and unreasonable if they didn't give me another shot because I was showing all this evidence of good faith and everything. So I went out there, having had this devastating experience. It was mostly the effect on my wife that was devastating to me. And I went out there, and by the way, my drinking, I suppose I should say something about that. I could not have been an alcoholic because I didn't drink like my dad. First of all, I didn't drink what my dad drank. He drank martinis. That's the only thing he ever drank. That's the only thing I ever saw him drink. He never made them. He made my mother make them and bring them to him, which must have been just exceedingly humiliating to her. I found it humiliating. I never saw him make a drink in his life. Never saw him touch a bottle of booze with his own hands. So I've never had a martini to this day. So that was one reason why I could not be an alcoholic. The other reason was I was a high class drinker. You know, I drank expensive stuff, you know, not cheap gin, you know. Stuff that tasted interesting. You know, and it tasted expensive, like Wild Turkey 101 or single malt scotch, which at the time cost about $22. I don't know what it costs today, maybe $60. Some of you guys have maybe drunk it recently could tell us, but you know, it was $22 25 years ago. It was a lot to spend on a, you know, bottle of booze. You know, imported wines, not, you know, real super expensive imported wines, but certainly not Gallo. And then imported beers, top it off with some cool Courvoisier or Rémy Martin. You don't quite pronounce the N in there, you know. So I was a high-class drinker. Plus, I'd never gotten a DUI ever. It just didn't seem to be causing a problem. However, the other little factor was, and again, this may not seem like a big deal to you, but I decided that very same Lent that I was going to not drink for Lent. you know, in my church at that time, you know, it was typical for you to make a think of something that you liked that you were going to give up for Lent. And, you know, for those of you from Yorba Linda, you know what Lent is, right? It's the time leading up to Easter in the Christian calendar where you're supposed to fast from certain foods. So, in preparation for celebrating the crucifixion and the resurrection. So, I decided I was going to quit drinking. And that lasted, I think, about 24 hours. And I think it unnerved me quite a bit. It doesn't sound like a big deal, I know. You know, I didn't have cops busting down the house or anything. My wife wasn't screaming, saying that she's going to take the kids. But here I was, a seminarian. I'm supposed to be serious about this stuff, and I couldn't do it. I couldn't do it for 24 hours. So that really, I think that kind of scared me. So here I am. I went out to Alena Lodge, and they have these daily kind of group sessions with everybody who's there. And then, you know, the whole point of it is, you know, we had all come from an alcoholic home. And then during the day, we would go over to the main building where they would have two times a day in the, I don't know, it was morning, either morning or afternoon, and then at night after dinner, they would have a an AA-type speaker meeting for all of the in-resident students, they called them, but we would also sit and participate, listen. And they would have an AA member, usually, either from the outside or somebody who was on the staff who was an AA member. And as part of the deal, they passed out these little pieces of paper after each speaker was finished, called critiques. And we're supposed to fill out these critiques. And, you know, I love that. I mean, you know, what alcoholic doesn't like to criticize? You know, and I was a great critiquer. You know, this is just right up my alley, so I'm writing these critiques all week. It's the most fun part of the week for me. So, yeah, I'm a smart guy. I'm in graduate school, right? So critique, it's just perfect. So then I get the word on Thursday. I arrived on Saturday or Sunday, and I get the word on Thursday that Mrs. Delaney wants me in her office before dinner. Now, this woman, the one word that comes to mind?
Tough.
Tough. Yeah, tough. Mean? she was a scary person in a certain way. I'll try to explain it. She was very intuitive. Okay, you know where it says in the big book, we will intuitively know how to handle situations that used to baffle us. Well, she was intuitive with a vengeance, because you just knew that she knew what you were thinking before you thought it. You just had that feeling whenever you were around her. You know, they have this saying in the Bible, which I think a lot of people misinterpret. It says, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of all wisdom. And the fear for me was that somebody could get inside of my head and knew my thoughts. That terrified me. And, you know, when you stop to think about it, if God, it really is God, if He did create all of us and everything, you know, then He pretty much knows what we're thinking. You know? Now, what were her initials? Is anybody listening? God, yeah. Geraldine Owen Delaney. And so, you know, she put the fear of God in people. And it was by design. Now, a lot of people who knew her secondhand or third hand, or never really got to know her like I did, thought she was mean. But she really loved alcoholics with all her heart. and her sole purpose in life was to save alcoholics, you know. And it was her life's work and her passion. So she called me in to her office, and she's sitting there. She sat me down, and she's sitting behind her desk. And she says, she's looking at me over her granny glasses like this and looking down and reading my critiques that I have written all week. And I'm thinking, oh, crap, what is this? And she says the following, which happened 25 years ago, plus, and it's still vivid in my mind. She says, you have a problem. And your problem is you don't know who you are. And you need to do something about that. And you need to begin by admitting that you're an alcoholic and joining AA. And I was literally dumbstruck. We had not discussed my drinking at all. I was here to discuss other people's drinking. You know, I had not discussed anything with her at all. In hindsight, though, I know that she saw me coming as soon as I got out of the car in the parking lot. And she said to herself, as soon as she saw me getting out of the car in the parking lot, I'm going to grab this one before the end of the week is over. Because that's just how she functioned. That's how she did things. And she grabbed me good. But it just wasn't her. I think there was somebody else involved. Because for some reason, I didn't argue. Now, again, this may not seem like a big deal to you. You know, it wasn't like the police were breaking down my door and cuffing me and saying, or putting the men with the white coats were coming and saying, you know, the jig is up. This is the end. It's just simple. You don't know who you are, and you need to do something about that. And I didn't argue. And that was a totally new experience for me. I'd never had that experience before in my life, because I always argued with you. And if it wasn't, why else would I get kicked out of seminary, for God's sake, you know? And these professors did not like their students arguing with them. And, you know, I mean, if my attitude was, if you think I'm arguing with you now, just wait. They didn't even like any difference of opinion about anything. So it was quite astonishing to me, both today and then, that I did not argue with this woman with what she said. And I not only did not argue out loud, but I did not argue in here. Which was even more incredible because, you know, I'm not always a confrontational person. My argument can go two ways, you know. I can be, I could have an explosive temper and be screaming at you and swearing, or I could just withdraw in my shell and be, you know, like, you know, the moody Welshman, you know, that is part of my heritage. But in either case, I was arguing and fighting and struggling with everybody and everything over everything. Always. And that didn't happen that evening. And I felt something happen. I felt, and let me just say that I can't remember which meeting it was, but I've been around since 1986 in AA, and last week, I think it was, I heard somebody in here exactly describe the experience that I had. Exactly. Verbatim. I felt lighter. I felt physically lighter. I felt as if up to that point in my life I had been carrying around a 100-pound sack of fertilizer on each shoulder but hadn't been aware of it, and somebody had come along and lifted those sacks of fertilizer off my shoulders. I use that analogy because I loaded a lot of sacks of fertilizer when I was much younger. I felt lighter. I felt different. And when I left that meeting and went out to dinner with my little group of children of alcoholics, they said, I look different. Anyway, so I was quiet, I was silent, and she said, how can I help you? And I remember saying to her, I think you already have. It just came out of my mouth. This is like not me talking at this point. And so we're sitting there. There might have been a little bit more conversation, and then she got a phone call. And hung up. She said, that was a call about one of our former students here. Has been sober 14 years. He's a Lutheran minister. He quit going to AA meetings and he's gone out and gotten drunk. Now, why would she get that call right then with me sitting in her room? I don't know. But I've just been told that I need to join it. I'm an alcoholic and join AA, and I've just been warned by somebody, my higher power maybe, that you need to take this very seriously. Because here's a case of a guy, religious guy, ordained minister, 14 years sober, he quit going to AA meetings, and he went out and got drunk. So I left there willing to go to any lengths to stay sober. Mrs. Delaney died a few years later. I got a call from somebody on the board, and I cried. I cried more about her death than I didn't cry when my dad died. I cried a little bit when my mom died. She was the parent I never really had. She had the most profound influence on my life of anybody in my life. I haven't had a real close sponsorship relationship. I do have kind of a really close friend that I use as a sponsor in AA, but it's almost like after Mrs. Delaney, what do you do? My one regret is I didn't avail myself of her insight more or spend more time with her. But, you know, life is what it is. My first AA meeting, I got back to southern Wisconsin, told my wife I was an alcoholic, I was joining AA, and I don't think she was terribly pleased about that, because her family's got the, you know, illness too, and it's like, oh my God, I've married, her first husband was a pothead, so here I've gone and done it again, as if somehow I hadn't been an alcoholic when she married me or something, you know. I'm kind of putting words in her mouth. I don't know what she thought. I think she was just kind of blindsided, you know. Anyway, Tim, can I get you to bring me another cup of coffee? This is ice cold and I'm a little dry mouth. Just black, thanks. So I called up the local AA intergroup when I got back to southern Wisconsin, and this was a Monday, and they gave me directions, very convoluted, extensive directions, thank you very much, to a AA meeting which was in Waukesha, about 30 miles away, 20 miles away, something like that. It took me about 40 minutes to get there, I think. I followed the directions to the letter, which is amazing. Because I don't follow directions to the letter almost ever, even today. And it was at a community center. And it was all motorcycle gang members. There were about 100 motorcycle gang members there. And then there was me. And so I came in and... they started the meeting, and I remember there was a very young guy started the meeting, younger than I was, and he had sitting next to him was this young lady, I assume was his girlfriend. She just looked like the way they were interacting, and she was one of the most gorgeous women, young ladies I've ever seen in my life. And I said to myself, I better not stare at this girl, because this guy's going to come over here and kick my, you know. I remember thinking that distinctly. And, I mean, there was nothing hostile about these people at all, but it was a motorcycle gang, you know. So, they had this custom. Of course, I was new to AA and didn't know, but they had this custom where they say, do we have any newcomers? And I raised my hand. First meeting. And so they, like, have some signals like this. And some guys stand up, small portion of the group, they stand up and they start walking into another room and they motion for me to follow them. And I don't know what the heck is going on. You know, I mean, is this some kind of weird initiation rite or something? And so we go back there, and what they do in Wisconsin is if you're in your first 90 days of sobriety, a small group would break off from the main group and they would have a first step meeting just for you. So I went to 90 meetings in 90 days, and in that 90 days, I probably went to 60 first step meetings that were just for me. And that's how I got started in this wonderful life, you know. And it hasn't always been wonderful, but when it hasn't been, it's been all my fault, you know, pretty much, anyway. I mean, I've had people stab me in the back in business. I've had people stab me in the back in church. I've been, you know, have people accuse me in AA of being a liar and doing all kinds of stuff that I didn't do. And, you know, I've lost my temper with people seriously, but not as seriously as back when I was drinking. But in each case, I mean, I played a part in it, you know. But it's been wonderful. It's a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful life. And I want to read a couple of things. This I read very early on, if I can find it. And it's from the big, big book. I hope nobody spazzes out on me. I'm not proselytizing for any particular religion here. But this, I'm telling you, this is part of my story. And I read this early on, and it really helped my AA program. If I can find it. Leviticus, Exodus, Deuteronomy. Here we go. Okay, we'll get there. All right. So, see, I mean, I had a guy one time tell me in my first home group, I feel sorry for you high-bottom drunks. It's so hard for you to stay sober. And he's right. He was right, you know. And he was trying to get my attention in a very loving way. And at the time, I was puzzled by it, though, and I read this. For this commandment which I command thee this day, it is not hidden from thee, neither is it far off. It is not in heaven that thou shouldst say, who shall go up for us to heaven and bring it unto us that we may hear it and do it. Neither is it beyond the sea that thou shouldst say, who shall go over the sea for us and bring it unto us that we may hear it and do it. But the word is very nigh unto thee, in thy mouth and in thy heart, that thou mayest do it. See, I have set before you here this day life and good, death and evil. In that I command thee this day to love the Lord thy God, to walk in his ways and keep his commandments and statutes and his judgments, that thou mayest live and multiply, and the Lord thy God shall bless thee in the land whither thou goest to possess it. But if thine heart turn away so that thou wilt not hear, but shall be drawn away and worship other gods and serve them, I got to tell you, booze was my God for 18 years. Anger was my God for a lot longer. I denounce unto you this day that you shall surely perish, and that you shall not prolong your days upon the land whither thou passest over Jordan to go to possess it. Now I'm thinking, okay, well, you know, this is telling me maybe something about my sobriety. I call heaven and earth to record this day against you that I have set before you life and death, blessing and cursing. Therefore choose life, that both thou and thy seed may live. And that struck me that if I want to live, I need to choose sobriety. I need to choose AA. If I don't, I'm choosing death. I'm choosing the way of death. And it's, you guys are offering me that choice every day. And I have to make that choice every day. And I'm not going to be coerced into it, you know. You're not going to be able to coerce me into it. You're just offering me that choice, life, death, blessings, or curses. I'll bring the death and curses on myself if I choose. And I'm perfectly capable of doing that. You know. And I can't forget, just because I'm a high bottom drunk, that this is about life and death. You know? And today, life does not have to be a curse for me. A good bit of my life, most of my life, I considered it really a curse. I mean, intellectually, I didn't really... I knew there was something wrong with that concept intellectually, but I lived my life as if I was cursed, and that life was a curse. You know? And when I was much younger, I despised God. I said, you know, why did you screw me like this? You know, why have you done this to me? You know, and when you're a kid, you don't have choices, you know, like we do, like you and I do today. But also, when you're drinking, when you're an active alcoholic, you really, I mean, I feel like I had in many ways lost the ability to truly, freely choose. You know, right and wrong, life, death. And so what AA has given me, what God has given me through you people, is that it gave me my freedom to choose and the ability to choose rightly. But it's not a done deal, you know. It just isn't. I mean, every day I have to make that choice. And one of the things that really makes it easy for me, comparatively easy, I think, is that, a couple of things. First of all, I just love AA. I don't particularly like all the people I've met in AA. And love is something that I'm still, you know, wondering, do I love anybody, you know? Do I love, I'm working on loving God and working on loving the people I'm close to. But when it comes right down to it, I don't particularly like people all that much, to be honest. Not really good with people. I'm working on it, but, you know, it's better than despising people, which I did, you know? But I really love AA. I love how AA works. I love, you know, you guys for what you are willing to offer to me. I respect any man that comes through that door, except for Tim. I think it's a real privilege to be an AA member. And so that makes it a little easier for me to make that choice. And the other thing is, and this is important for me, it's not important for maybe for you or for all that many AA members, but it's important for some, and that is I've been able to kind of integrate my church's teachings with the AA teaching and AA with my church's teaching and not to confuse the two. Or anything like that, but I found some help in that area, There's a lot of good stuff in my religion's tradition that I found helpful, because AA does not make an attempt to get real profoundly theological, and I think that that's a good thing and a necessary thing. But, you know, there's nothing more profound I've read anywhere than just what I'm about to read to you now, which I'm telling you, if you can get to this point in AA where you can appreciate this passage like I do today, everything will be different for you. Everything will be different. I mean, I realize that we come in here and we struggle just to stop drinking, and then we discover it's maybe more about... there's more to life than just not drinking. There's more to AA than just not drinking. But there's a whole another level to this, which I've discovered in this passage. Showing others who suffer how we were given help is the very thing which makes life seem so worthwhile to us now. I've had plenty of moments in AA where I just thought my life was not worth living because I made big mistakes. And from my perspective at that point in time, I thought my life was pointless and over. And I had to find something other than material things or worldly success or even success in my relations with my family, so that I would know for sure that life was worthwhile. Because I've got to tell you, if this alcoholic starts thinking that life is not worthwhile, that is a very, very dangerous place for me to be. So I'm going to read this again. Showing others who suffer how we were given help is the very thing which makes life seem so worthwhile to us now. Cling to the thought that in God's hands, the dark past is the greatest possession you have. I kid you not, this is in this book, folks. It's on page 124. It's incredible. Cling to the thought that in God's hands, the dark past is the greatest possession you have, the key to life and happiness for others. Others. With it, you can avert death and misery for them. Imagine, for them. So, are you telling me that my purpose in being an AA member is to be able to avert death and misery for others? Wow. Who gets to do that? And not expect to be paid. and not expect to get any medals or rewards, you know. I mean, in my church, if you're a big donor to the church, they make a big deal about it, and they get you up there, and they give you, something to wear on your coat, you know. And the money is all, you know, I mean, it does good works. Don't get me wrong, but, you know, in AA, we don't get paid. We don't get rewards. We don't get honors. Thank God for that. We have something a lot more valuable. We have an opportunity in here to do things that makes life worthwhile by simply sharing our dark past with others who are still suffering, so that they know they're not unique and they're not alone. That's all. And it's just so simple. It's really easy when you stop to think about it. You know. I mean, I'd love to write the great American novel or the last work in philosophy. You know. So after, are you thinking about getting a doctorate in philosophy? No, no. After Jones's book, it's pointless. You know, that's how I think. But in here, we just keep it real simple. We're not trying to save the whole damn world. Well, some of us think along those lines every once in a while. We kind of think, well, if only everybody in the world had a program. If only AA could be everybody's program. You know, the world would be a wonderful place. Well, let's just worry about the guy who just walked in the door, shall we? You know? Let's keep it simple. And boy, am I grateful for that. Just the simple opportunity. All I got to do is just share my dark past with an alcoholic who's still suffering so that he doesn't feel unique and alone, and my life becomes worthwhile. Regardless of whatever else is going on in my life, rich or poor, broke or, you know, alone or happily married or whatever, you have given me an opportunity to do that. It's a great privilege. And, you know, in my church, I love my church, but, you know, there's very few opportunities for service other than, you know, helping out with bake sales, unless you're a priest or a monk. And so I'll conclude with my monk joke on that note. I think he was an AA guy, in fact, come to think of it. And I've known a couple of AA guys who have become monks. They're very good monks. One guy is out in a tiny little monastery in the high desert in New Mexico. He's an Orthodox monk. They never shave. They never cut their hair. They never bathe. And the other guy is in Mount Athos in Greece. And great guys. And I haven't seen them for years because they're monks, you know, but they're great guys. Anyway, this monk, this guy who's an AA guy, he's decided, well, you know, really he wanted to kick it up a notch. And, you know, he loved the spirituality of AA, but he decided he was going to be a monk. So he joins this monastery. It's a very strict monastery where you have to take a vow of silence. But once every 10 years, you can have a face-to-face meeting with an abbot, and you're allowed to say four words. So after the first 10 years, he goes in and he has this first meeting with the abbot. He says to him, "My food tastes bad." And the abbot just nods his head and dismisses him with a hand. He comes back in 10 years later and he says, "My bunk's too hard." The abbot nods his head and dismisses him. Comes back in 10 years later, says to the abbot, "My cellmate," they live in what they call cells, "My cellmate smells bad." The abbot nods his head and dismisses him. 10 years later, 40 years now, he comes in and he says to the abbot, "I quit." And the abbot says, "Well, I'm not surprised. All you've done since you got here is whine and bitch and moan and complain." So on that note, thank you and good night. But we do have chips. And Tisley's going to hand them out for us.
My name is Tinsley. I'm an alcoholic. And thank you, Owen, for that that story. It's the third time I've heard you tell your story, and it's different every time. And I did not know there was any such thing as an alcoholic monk. But if there was, he would be the chipmunk, and that's what I'm doing here. I write all my own material. Did I say I'm an alcoholic?
Yeah.
Corny alcoholic. Okay. If you're new and you'd like to try this way of life one day at a time, we offer a white chip. Would anybody like to pick up a white chip? Try this way of life one day at a time. After 30 days, we have a silver chip. Have we got 30 days? How about 90 days, the red chip? 6 months, yellow chip. Green Chip for 9 months. Any birthdays? Blue Chip? Anybody want to reconsider on a white chip? Big hand for the chips you hold.
Thank you, Tinsley. Do we have any AA-related announcements? Yes, Kevin.
I'm an alcoholic.
Yeah.
Yes, barbecue by Amanda's Tavern. That big rig out back, they brought that over to help us promote it, and it's going to be smelling good around here Saturday night, so it's going to be great. And we have quite a few performers in the lineup, real special. But Tinsley's going to play at 9, and then he's going to close the show. So everybody should be happy. What else we got? Next week, David T. of the Big Book Bunch. He's coming and telling his story. He's got a long history of working with folks in AA at the Georgia Mental Health Institute. So we'll be able to get that perspective. And then Rachel H., Debbie O's daughter, is going to be the week after that. So she sometimes chairs for us, and we're really looking forward to her coming to the podium. Any other announcements before we wrap it up? Okay. Well, I'd like to remind everybody that anonymity is the foundation of... I don't have it in front of me, but let's keep everybody's anonymity. And for those who will, let's join hands in the Lord's Prayer.
Amen.